This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. A comedian calls on Congress to act. Congress calls for a raise. And Christians call out serious issues during two major conventions. Plenty to discuss today on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us in studio is Reed Wilson, a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hey, Joshua.
Kimberly Adams is a correspondent for Marketplace. Kimberly, welcome.
Hi, Joshua.
And Naftali Ben-David is a political editor for The Washington Post. Hi, Naftali.
Thanks so much for having me.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Now, we've heard about the comments that the president made, but there's another story that made news this week that we believe we wanted to start with. We'll get to the president in just a second. And we're starting with this story because it's been ignored for way too long. It came back to the top of the news agenda thanks to comedian Jon Stewart. He's known for funny, smart political humor as the former host of The Daily Show, but this week he addressed Congress, and no one was laughing.
Behind me, a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress. Sick and dying, they brought themselves down here to speak. To no one. It's shameful. It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution. The official FDNY response time to 9/11 was 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's how long it took for FDNY, for NYPD, for Port Authority, for EMS to respond to an urgent need from the public. 5 seconds. Hundreds died in an instant. Your indifference cost these men and women their most valuable commodity, time.
That was Jon Stewart testifying before the House Judiciary Committee about the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund. Naftali, let me start with you. This was a fund that was started in 2001 and then reauthorized in 2010. But what's the issue with the fund now?
The issue is essentially that it's running low and there's still many claims left. The fund started out with $7.3 billion and they've paid out roughly 20,000 claims, but they have roughly 20,000 more to go as well. And it was going to expire and still could, unless the Senate acts, in 2020. So they're trying to both extend it and provide more funds for the first responders. Obviously, it's always a bit of a scene, a bit of a spectacle when a celebrity comes to the Hill. Many people argue that it shouldn't have taken that for this issue to have garnered such attention. But I've noticed in the past that when members of Congress who are have no problem facing down a president or a cabinet secretary, when a celebrity comes, they're cowed in a whole different way. And obviously that, combined with sort of the moral force of this particular issue, created for a pretty unusual moment on Capitol Hill.
Well, and especially a political commentator who is certainly no fan of the president, but who had some of the most kind of stirring and inspirational remarks right after 9/11. I remember when The Daily Show went back on the air, Kimberly, and he said that the view from his home used to be the World Trade Center, but after they were burned down, the view is now the Statue of Liberty. So he was one of the first political commentators to kind of help the nation refocus after this tragedy.
And he's been long advocating for the Victims Fund. This is something he's been coming down to the Hill for many years, pushing for this. And I think that the people who are still suffering these consequences have been speaking out very fondly of the work that he's done on this issue. But it's like Naftali was saying, I mean, it's really a struggle to imagine why it took this. So the bill was voted out of committee and they're expecting it to move forward, but it still remains to be seen if it's going to move forward unattached to any other legislation. This was one of the complaints that Jon Stewart had in his comments, is that so often funding for this gets attached to something else that gets caught up in the politics, and then it just sort of fades away into the background. So Congress in its current state, you know, it's a real question whether or not they're going to let this be a standalone issue or if it will get caught up in those politics.
So, Reed Wilson, just to put it simply, what the hell's taking so long?
Well, the normal legislative process. The Congress rarely acts on in a efficient manner when their backs aren't against the wall. When something is about to expire, it usually passes pretty quickly, sort of in the last minute, in the last days of any given Congress. And I think that's likely what's going to happen in this case. As Naftali said, the fund doesn't expire until next year. There are a significant number. I think it's 70% of the claims have been. Or they need to reduce the payouts from the claims by about 70% in order to make sure there's enough money so the fund doesn't run out basically before it expires. But it is making its way through the process. It passed the Judiciary Committee, as Kimberly said. It's got 312 co-sponsors in the House, so it's probably going to pass the House of Representatives. The question is, when does it move through the Senate, which has become its own sort of legislative graveyard of late? The Senate has been moving, a huge percentage of the votes that the Senate has taken have been on nominations in the last few weeks, months, years. They have taken fewer votes on actual pieces of legislation. We'll see whether or not and when Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell schedules it for a vote, but once the House passes it.
Kimberly?
And this is the other thing that tends to happen with legislation like this that does have a lot of support and a lot of attention. It makes it even more attractive, to put it in a strange way, for members to attach things that maybe might be more difficult to pass, because then it ends up becoming this political football. Oh, you don't want to fund, the first responders for 9/11 just because of this small thing that I attached, poison pills and all these other terms that we end up hearing. So how it moves forward will really matter in terms of what happens.
Naftali Ben-David, when did this become a political football? Was it always? I mean, it seemed like right after 9/11, the idea that the federal government would compensate victims of a terror attack, which happened through no fault of their own, was kind of a no-brainer. What happened?
Well, there's a difference between the Victims Fund, which goes to the families and survivors of the event itself, and the First Responders Fund. And that did take a little bit longer to catch on as a real issue. I don't think it was as automatic for some people. This had to do with a lot of the clouds of toxins that were in the air when these people responded. There's another slightly weird element to all this, which is that John Stewart had this comment that the terrorists didn't shout death to Tribeca, they shouted death to America. And it's unclear exactly what he was getting at there, but there was an implication that maybe there's a bit of an anti-New York, anti-East Coast overlay to the whole thing, and that Congress might have moved quicker if it was a different group of people.
Yeah, I heard him say that. I think what he meant is that, it's been left as kind of a local or regional or a state funding issue, as if this was purely New York's problem, as if the attack represented something that New York had to deal with, as opposed to an attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and another plane that was intended for the White House but crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, that took off in Newark that was bound for San Francisco.
I mean, that certainly could be what he was referring to. It felt to me like there was a little bit of ambiguity there that was open to interpretation. And there has been some discussion around this issue about, well, it's New York City, and is that perhaps why there's some difficulty getting some of this stuff through Congress that might have passed through much more easily were it involving some other issue in some other part of the country?
So Reed, do we have a sense of where this goes from here? Obviously, John Stewart kind of shamed this committee into moving the bill forward. I don't know if Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said whether he'll bring this bill to the Senate for a vote.
Not that I've heard. It would be this feels like one of those things that passes under unanimous consent when 99 senators are out of Washington, D.C. As Mitch McConnell has made clear time and again, the most precious resource that Congress has is time. And there is a limited time on the Senate floor. His priorities don't necessarily line up with the priorities of the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the other party right now. And if Mitch McConnell wants to take floor time to actually debate this issue and eventually pass it, that means less time for the judicial nominees that they're trying to pass or the administration nominees who have been on hold for a while. So, we'll see. Primarily what I think is going to happen is Mitch McConnell will strike some deal with the Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, and this, who by the way is from New York, and this will pass unanimous consent. You can't imagine any senator objecting to funding for this, unlike say the disaster relief bill that got held up in the House a few weeks ago. The House and the Senate are very different institutions. Once this passes the House, it will get through the Senate. It's a matter of when McConnell makes it a priority on the floor.
Kimberly?
It's interesting to hear about, you know, sort of time being the most valuable commodity in the Senate. And that was something that, as John Stewart said in the clip that you played, time being is the most valuable commodity for these first responders. And if you had the opportunity to watch the hearing, or if you didn't, you can go back and watch it. I'm pretty sure it's on C-SPAN. You know, many of the several people testified, some of these first responders, and to see them and to see how they're suffering was quite powerful.
Also worth noting, by the way, Naftali, before we pause, that Congress also debated cost of living raises. They have not received one in about 10 years. Looks like that might continue.
Yeah, it's just an impossible issue for members of Congress. I mean, most of us don't get to vote on our own salary, let alone from taxpayer dollars. There's some arguments why they really should have a cost of living increase after 10 years. They have to maintain two households. You don't want only wealthy people to be able to run for Congress. But it's just an absolute loser, particularly for some of these Democratic freshmen in swing Republican districts. And so, yeah, it's going to remain in limbo.
Before we pause, just a reminder, with regards to this bill, 2,977 people were killed in the September 11th attacks. 412 of them were emergency workers, 343 firefighters, 37 police officers from the Port Authority, 23 NYPD officers, 8 emergency medical technicians, and 1 patrolman from the New York Fire Patrol. Much more to discuss as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, Naftali Ben-David of The Washington Post, and Reed Wilson of The Hill. We'll talk about the comments that President Trump made. Today is his 73rd birthday, by the way. He spent part of the morning on Fox and Friends. We'll share some of what he's been talking about. Also, we'll explain why this song, playing underneath my voice right now, is on repeat in St. Louis. I bet Kimberly knows why.
I do.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. The U.S. Army has never, in its 244-year history, had an infantry division with a woman in command. Until now. In about 2 weeks, Laura Yeager will break that barrier. Yeager is a brigadier general and a highly decorated helicopter pilot who enlisted back in 1986. She most recently commanded the Joint Task Force North, supporting federal law enforcement from U.S. Northern Command at Fort Bliss, Texas. On June 29th, Yeager will assume command of the 40th Infantry Division of the California National Guard. In an email to the New York Times, she wrote, quote, "My most important responsibility is ensuring my soldiers are ready to fight and win our nation's wars while also being prepared to serve the citizens of California during natural disasters," unquote. It's the Friday News Roundup with Marketplace correspondent Kimberly Adams, Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, and the author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak, and Naftali Ben-David, a political editor for The Washington Post. Well, today is President Trump's 73rd birthday. He started the day with a live telephone interview on Fox and Friends. He said, among other things, that he has no plans to fire advisor Kellyanne Conway. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel recommended that she be fired for what it says were multiple violations of the Hatch Act. The Hatch Act prohibits federal employees from using their official government posts for partisan reasons. But there was another interview with the president that captured the nation's attention this week. His comments to ABC's George Stephanopoulos were just about all Washington could talk about in the last 48 hours, especially this part.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. I don't, there's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong.
That was President Trump in part of an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos. More excerpts from the interview are coming out every few days, and there will be a longer form version of the interview next week. The president did appear on Fox and Friends this morning. In part, he said that he would report this to the FBI, at least if he sensed something was wrong. The president said this morning on Fox and Friends, quote, If I thought anything was incorrect or badly stated, I'd report it to the Attorney General, the FBI, I'd report it to law enforcement absolutely, unquote. So he somewhat backtracked on his comment. Reed Wilson, I'm not one for hyperbole, but let's just bottom line this. The President of the United States was asked by an American citizen if he would abide by the laws of federal elections in his bid to become president again, to win a second term. He was asked if he would be willing to break one of those laws, and the president said yes. Is that fair? Is that accurate?
That's absolutely fair. And as a matter of fact, part of the walk back has been to sort of muddle into this quagmire even more. The top campaign spokesperson told CBS last night that they would handle the possibilities of foreign intervention on a, quote, case-by-case basis, which to me sort of sounds like they're expecting multiple cases of this to come up. The chairwoman of the Federal Election Commission, Ellen Weintraub, a Democratic appointee, to be fair, but still the chair of the FEC, issued a remarkable statement last night in which she said that she had to reiterate that it is still illegal for an American campaign to accept any form of help from a foreign government, anything of value, which includes information. That was a pretty remarkable statement in and of itself. But President Trump got a lot of pushback on this, even from some people who have been his staunchest allies. Senator Lindsey Graham said that, you know, this is absolutely not the appropriate path to take, but this is something like President Trump just doesn't back down on these things because the notion of Russian interference in the 2016 election is such a challenge to his own concept of his legitimate win that he seems unable to accept that this is not how we do things in American politics.
Let me read a bit more of that comment from the statement from Ellen Weintraub, who's the chair of the Federal Election Commission. She wrote in part, quote, "Electoral intervention from foreign governments has been considered unacceptable since the beginnings of our nation. Our founding fathers sounded the alarm about foreign interference, intrigue, and influence. They knew that when foreign governments seek to influence American politics, it is always to advance their own interests, not America's. Anyone who solicits or accepts foreign assistance risks being on the wrong end of a federal investigation." That's from Ellen Weintraub, who's the chair of the Federal Election Commission. But Kimberly Adams, what difference will this make? The president said, yeah, I might do it. Maybe I'll tell the FBI. George Stephanopoulos said, well, the FBI director Chris Wray says that you should call this out, you should report it. And the president said the FBI director is wrong. So where does this leave us?
Well, it leaves us at the end of that statement from Chair Weintraub, which is, could find themselves at the end of an investigation. Well, the FEC hasn't been doing as many investigations as usual because they're short-staffed, and because of the split on that committee, they're not able to necessarily move through as many of those investigations or come to a resolution as they might. And, you know, she also said in that statement that even soliciting this information is against the law, and Speaker Pelosi accused the president yesterday that his statements in this interview were, in fact, a solicitation. That's basically opening the door to foreign governments to come in with this information. And so what does it all mean? What does it all do? I think this is another example where we've seen a lot of breaking of traditions in this administration, to put it mildly. And what will happen is there will probably be lawsuits, and those lawsuits will work their way through the courts. Like many of the other challenges we've seen against some of the actions of this administration, it will probably go to the courts. What will be more interesting to see is what this actually means for the running of the campaign. I think we'll have people throughout the presidential campaign, whenever something comes out against the eventual Democratic nominee, people wondering where that information came from.
And Naftali, this is not just putting pressure on the president and his campaign, of course, the additional scrutiny that is sure to come. I think this is also kind of putting pressure on Democrats, too, because the drumbeat for impeachment, or at least impeachment proceedings, has been growing. I'm not sure how the Democratic leadership listens to this statement and the follow-up and can still say proceedings are not the right idea, this isn't the way to go. The president said he would break the law to win a second term. How do you deal with that if you're Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I think Nancy Pelosi has said all along the issue isn't whether or not he's broken the law. In fact, she said very explicitly, according to reports, she told her members that she'd be happy to see him in prison. That her argument has always been that politically it's not the right thing to do, not so much whether or not legally or ethically it's the right thing to do. But one of the things that was striking about this comment wasn't just the issue of whether or not it broke the law, but it implicates a whole broader idea of what it is to be elected in America, and the idea that it's Americans getting together as this great democracy and choosing among themselves who is going to lead them for the next few years. And the idea that he blithely talked about this idea of accepting help from some kind of a foreign entity or foreign government, that symbolizes to me something different and maybe even deeper than a violation of the law, but something about what we philosophically believe as a country. And I think that that's one reason that it ignited such a reaction, is because of that particular implication.
With regards to that philosophical belief, Tom in Carlisle, Pennsylvania writes, "When I was growing up, the ethic of competition was it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. Over the decades, that ethic has been replaced by winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Trump, McConnell, and the Republican Party are the natural result of that change in cultural values." Reed Wilson, I think that quote is Vince Lombardi, is it? Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. But setting that aside, what Tom is saying, I understand where he's coming from. I wonder if in a way that applies to both the Republicans and the Democrats at this point. If the President Trump says, yeah, I'm willing to bend the rules because it's politically expedient, Nancy Pelosi says, no, I'm not willing to pursue impeachment because it's politically expedient. This seems to be a problem across the spectrum.
And it's a problem that's been growing over the last several decades. I mean, you can trace this back to Watergate. But the bottom line is our government is becoming more political on a daily basis. I mean, you touched on the fact that Kellyanne Conway, a government ethics office, has said she ought to be fired because of multiple violations of the Hatch Act. And her response was something to the effect of, let me know when the prison sentence begins, effectively laughing off the notion that she's violating a sentence. Century-old law when she uses her government taxpayer-funded salary and position to talk about politics. And this is a problem across the board that government has become more political. I think there are a lot of Democrats, Democratic strategist types, especially veterans of the Obama administration and veterans of sort of a younger generation of Capitol Hill staffers who are now off the Hill, who are pushing Pelosi to begin these impeachment investigations regardless of the political consequences for a couple of reasons. First of all, they think the politics will actually be good for them. Months of investigation will turn up the things that effectively Robert Mueller was investigating and possibly other nefarious things that the administration has done in the course of Congress's regular oversight of the executive branch. And the second part is, what's the point of getting elected if the only goal is to get reelected? Why not? Their point is, why not take on your literal constitutional obligation to conduct oversight, and that means investigations into the White House? That is frustrating for a lot, and I think a growing portion of the Democratic left.
By the way, just a quick search, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing, is attributed to Vince Lombardi. It apparently originated with Red Sanders, who is a football coach at UCLA. Let's move on, Kimberly, to something else involving the president this week, and that's the fight over the 2020 census. The president invoked executive privilege to block Congress from getting documents related to that citizenship question. On Wednesday, the Democratic-controlled House Oversight and Reform Committee voted to recommend that the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, and the Attorney General, William Barr, be held in contempt of Congress. Does the president have a basis for invoking executive privilege on this?
Well, the president has said, or the administration has said, that these documents are basically being held under executive privilege because Congress has not been working with them well enough to give them time to review the documents to see which ones are appropriate to release. And so shortly before this contempt vote came down is when the White House announced that they were going to hold back these documents under executive privilege. And so the idea was, it's because you're not working with us well enough that we're doing this. And so they're claiming attorney-client privilege and other things. It's clearly part of this political maneuvering about how much the White House has to share with Congress. Another thing likely to end up in the courts.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Yesterday, we learned that Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, will be leaving her post. She's been with Mr. Trump for 3.5 years, starting with his campaign. One moment, though, in her tenure stands out in particular. At a press briefing on May 11th, 2017, Mrs. Sanders responded to questions from reporters about the firing of Jim Comey, the former FBI director. She backed up statements from the White House that Comey had lost the confidence of rank-and-file members of the Intelligence Bureau.
Well, I can speak to my own personal experience. I've heard from countless members of the FBI that are grateful and thankful for the president's decision. And I think that, we may have to agree to disagree. I'm sure that there are some people that are disappointed, but I've certainly heard from a large number of individuals, and that's just myself. And I don't even know that many people in the FBI.
Just to follow up on the FBI thing, And I'm not trying to be overly combative here, but you said now today, and I think you said again yesterday, that you personally have talked to countless FBI officials, employees, since this happened.
Correct.
I mean, really? Like,
Are we talking between like email, like, text messages?
Like
absolutely.
50?
Yes.
60, 70?
We're not going to get into a numbers game. I have heard from a large number of individuals that work at the FBI that said that they're very happy with the president's decision. I mean, I don't know what else I can say.
That was Sarah Sanders speaking during a press briefing in May of 2017. Later, she testified to special counsel Robert Mueller's office and admitted that that claim was baseless. Worth noting that Sean Spicer, the former press secretary, tweeted, "One of the best decisions I made was asking Sarah Huckabee to serve as White House principal deputy press secretary. She is hardworking, loyal, strategic, and a true friend through thick and thin. She's been a tireless advocate for President Donald Trump and this administration's policies." Naftali, I noticed that Sean did not call her truthful or honest, and I think that this kind of blew her credibility out of the water. But in the end, it seems like it didn't matter because the president is kind of his own press secretary.
I mean, I think that's true. What was remarkable about that was a couple things. First of all, rarely do you have a proceeding where somebody's placed under oath and you can really determine without question whether they were lying or not. The second thing is the explanations that were given to Mueller were A, that it was a slip of the tongue, and B, that it was heat of the moment. And I think what that exchange shows is that it really was a lot more calculated and persistent than that. One thing occurred to me when I heard this. I remember that Mike McCurry, who was the press secretary for President Clinton during some pretty tough times, he used to talk about how his office was located halfway between the Oval Office and the reporter's briefing room, and that symbolized the way he tried to strike this balance between the interests of the press and the interests of the presidency. And whether you think that was true or not, you can't even imagine Sarah Sanders saying something like that. She was a warrior for the president, plain and simple. She changed the job by not having press briefings, but instead talking to Fox and having these gaggles. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, as in so many things, in the next administration, whether they continue that and that becomes the new normal or whether it's an aberration.
Kimberly, one thing I wanted to ask you about before we have to pause. President Trump teased a secret deal with Mexico regarding the crisis at the border. On Tuesday, he said this to the press after taking a folded piece of paper out of his pocket.
"That's the agreement that everybody says I don't have. So, no, because I'm going to let Mexico do the announcement at the right time. From Mexico, they want to go through. But here's the agreement. It's a very simple agreement. This is one page. This is one page of a very long and very good agreement for both Mexico and the United States. Without the tariffs, we would have had nothing."
That was the president speaking on Tuesday. On Monday, Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, said at a news conference that there was no secret deal between Mexico and the U.S. Kimberly, what is going on? And if, in fact, there is no deal, what's next? Does this mean tariffs may still be on the way?
Tariffs may still be on the way, but they are at least on hold for now. We're talking about at least a 5% tariffs. The Trump administration called for 5% tariffs on everything being imported from Mexico. Those are on hold. There's no secret deal, according to the Mexican government, but there is some shape of an arrangement, at least, where Mexico is going to boost its National Guard forces along its southern border to try to stem the flow of migrants heading north. There also are other agreements that are not known to everyone about what the Mexican government is going to do to try to reduce it. What was, as captured by an enterprising photographer in the White House press corps, seen on that piece of paper was sort of an arrangement that if they didn't slow it down in the next 45 days, maybe there would be additional steps.
We got to take a pause for a minute, but before we do, two hip-hop legends made news this week. Brad Jordan, the Houston native known as Scarface, says he will run for Houston's city council. Scarface had several hits in the 90s and early 2000s, including Smile, Guess Who's Back, and Let Me Roll. He was part of a rap group called the Ghetto Boys, which lost one of its members this week. Richard Shaw, better known as Bushwick Bill, died this week after fighting pancreatic cancer. He lived to be 52. The Ghetto Boys were pioneers of Southern rap. Their biggest hit, My Mind Is Playing Tricks on Me, famously samples Isaac Hayes and still shows up on a lot of Halloween playlists. We'll get back to the roundup in just a minute. Stay close.
This year, Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys are trick-or-treating, robbing little kids for bags, till a little man got behind our rags. So we speeded up the pace, took a look back, and he was right before our face.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Naftali Ben-David, Reed Wilson, and Kimberly Adams. Yesterday, the Democratic National Committee announced the candidates who qualified for the first set of 2020 presidential primary debates. Those debates will take place June 26th and 27th at the Adrian Arsh Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Miami. Of the two dozen candidates, four didn't make it. Governor Steve Bullock of Montana, Wayne Messam, who is the mayor of Miramar, Florida, which is on the west edge of Broward County, Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, and former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. Reed Wilson, what are the chances for the candidates who don't get in this first round of debates? I mean, theoretically, the DNC didn't say you're out. They said you're just not in this time.
You're not in this time. The good news for these four candidates, well, let's start with the bad news. The bad news is they are missing out on the single largest platform that these candidates are going to have. 10 million or more people are going to tune into these debates. It may be the first time that a lot of Democratic voters and activists hear from a large number of them. And of course, it's going to be a great opportunity to introduce themselves and talk about why they want to be the president of the United States. These four candidates don't have that opportunity. The good news is it's not the sort of opportunity that other candidates have had in the past. I mean, this isn't Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton versus John Edwards. This is 10 people on a stage for 2 hours at a time, which basically means they're only going to have 5 to 7 minutes to make their case. And of course, there are back-to-back debates. So you've got 10 people on Wednesday the 26th, 10 people on Thursday the 27th. They're not going to really have that much time to stand out in the field. The better news for these candidates is they still have a second shot. There is another debate that will operate under the current rules that will happen in late July on CNN. So these candidates can meet one of the two thresholds required to get on the debate stage. Either they have to receive 1% in three different polls. Steve Bullock at the moment is at 1% in two polls, and he claims to have been at 1% in a third poll. There's a whole backstory to that that is way too complicated and involves open-ended polling questions in the Washington Post and ABC. The second criteria is they need to receive at least 65,000 individual donations, that is, donations from 65,000 individual people spread across a large number of states. So it's still possible that these four candidates can qualify for the next debate, but the fact is they are missing out on the single biggest platform available to the entire party so far.
Kimberly?
And I will just say, to highlight this, the importance of this debate or these types of debates, I might, you know, hearken back to the last presidential election where an underdog candidate was able to stand out in a very crowded primary field.
Remember Jeb Bush, everybody? Because he was the front runner when we started.
He was the front runner, and Donald Trump really raised his profile in those debates. He had very little time, but he was able to dominate many of those debates and move on to obviously win the presidency. And but for those candidates that did get left out this time, you know, this polling threshold, even if they're able to make it eventually, they're coming up very quickly on needing to hit a threshold for the next round of debates, which are even tougher. 2% in the polls, I believe, and then 130,000 individual donors across dozens of states. So this really is a hard blow for many of these candidates.
Well, Naftali, to the point that Kimberly made, and I'm glad you made the point about Donald Trump at a time when Jeb Bush was widely viewed as the front runner. I mean, part of what Donald Trump was able to do, for better or worse, in the primaries was just kind of be so outrageous and kind of unmissable that he began to rise in people's attention, and then he gained a following, and that made him the front runner. What can we expect from these debates? It seems like with so many people and so little time, that might be their best way to kind of rise in the polls, is to have a viral moment, to just be, you know, be the kid in the back of the room throwing spitballs, and then all of a sudden, oh, that's who that person is. Let me Google him.
I think that's exactly right, because I think that a lot of people aren't going to sit through two nights in a row of 2 hours each of 20 candidates.
But what they Unless they live within 10 miles of where we're sitting right now, basically.
right, and maybe some in Iowa. But, but for the most part, what they're going to do is watch the reports on it afterwards and see what's online about it afterwards. So if you can create a moment that's likely to be encapsulated in the coverage afterward, I think that's going to be everybody's goal. So we could see a little bit of a chaotic free-for-all kind of debate where everybody, and particularly the candidates that aren't polling as well, try to have their moment. This is this very tough challenge for the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, because they don't want to be accused of rigging the debates in any way, as they were, you know, last time accused of rigging the primaries for Hillary Clinton. But on the other hand, there's 20 plus candidates, and a lot of Democratic voters are tired of the whole thing and want it to be narrowed down a little bit. So they've tried to strike this balance, and I think that's why we're going to see a dramatically shrunk field for the September debate over the June and July debates.
I do think it'll be interesting, partly because it's in Miami, and Miami is one of those media markets where, first of all, it's Miami, and Florida is just a crazy place. But also, it's kind of the hub of where English and Spanish media meet. Jose Diaz-Balart from Telemundo is one of the moderators. It'll be broadcast in English and Spanish. And so it's kind of this perfect place if you want to reach Latino voters, where Spanish language networks are headquartered, where like the main political reporters are. It could be very interesting. And I'll be interested to see how Latino voters and Spanish-speaking voters or bilingual voters react to these candidates. But Joe Biden has been making a lot of news this week also, especially during rallies in Iowa on Tuesday. He and President Trump spent some time criticizing one another. Here's a little mashup.
4 years of Donald Trump will go down in history as an aberration, but 8 years, he will fundamentally change the nature of who we are as a country. He embraces dictators like Kim Jong-un, who's a damn murderer and a thug. Well, the one thing they agree on, Joe Biden, they shouldn't be president.
Well, I heard Biden, who's a loser. I mean, look, Joe never got more than 1%, except Obama took him off the trash heap, and now it looks like he's failing. It looks like his friends from the left are going to overtake him pretty soon. Oh, I'd rather run against, I think, Biden than anybody. I think he's the weakest mentally.
Those were former President Joe Biden at a rally in Iowa and President Trump in D.C. before leaving for Iowa. Now, the president's comments, Reid, might be the least of Joe Biden's worries. In a big poll in Iowa, his lead slipped. Elizabeth Warren surged in a number of polls. What do you make of the timing, the impact, the strategy behind these comments about President Trump by Joe Biden?
So Joe Biden is trying to run, call it the modified Rose Garden strategy. He does not want to be one of 20 Democratic candidates who's running. You haven't seen him engage with any of the other Democratic candidates in the field. He's not talking about, Jay Inslee's climate plan or Elizabeth Warren's her 8,000th plan that she's unveiled so far. He is directly contrasting himself with President Trump because that's the best way for his campaign to remind voters that he is the what he wants to convey as the most electable candidate in the Democratic field. The problem, though, is that that doesn't appear to be working. It's not at least building his lead. As you mentioned, this Iowa poll, this is the sort of the benchmark poll that everybody pays attention to by a very well-respected pollster named Ann Selzer. Biden's lead slipped from 32 points back in December just to 24. He's got 24% of the vote now. And I think there's a pretty clear, call it the second tier emerging among Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Kamala Harris, who are all sort of competing for that the prime real estate in the polling field right now. Joe Biden is promising to, his line is make America, America again. He's sort of hearkening back to the past, to the Clinton era, to the Obama era. And that's not what a lot of Democratic voters are talking about. I think that's why we've seen Elizabeth Warren harnessing this sort of success of releasing plan after plan after plan to deal with the future. You know, every candidate now has a climate plan. Joe Biden just released his this week. The bottom line is Democratic voters seem to be looking towards the future. And if they are looking for that future, the candidate of the past is not necessarily the guy to capture their votes.
Let's shift gears to religion that made the news this week. Leaders of America's two largest Christian denominations, the Southern Baptist Convention and the Catholic Church, met this week to deal with critical challenges facing each of their denominations. Both of them are reeling from reports of widespread sexual abuse of children by church leaders and the cover-ups that followed. At their meetings, both groups passed measures that are aimed at preventing abuse and cover-ups from happening in the future. Among other things, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops plans to create a nationwide system to report abuse complaints. The Southern Baptist Convention will amend its constitution, allowing it to kick churches out that mishandle abuse. Now, these meetings also come at a time when both faiths are contending with the treatment of women and LGBT people. This week, the Vatican officially rejected the idea that individuals can choose their own gender identities. An official document titled Male and Female He Created Them, which is a Bible quote, says that gender fluidity is, quote, nothing more than a confused concept of freedom in the realm of feelings and wants, unquote. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. We don't usually end with sports, but we should today. I'm going to accept that my Golden State Warriors lost the NBA Finals. The Toronto Raptors eked out a victory. They won by 4 points. It was 114 to 110. The first NBA championship for a Canadian team. Drake was very happy about it. I'm rooting for the Warriors next year. Anyway, we're going to move on from that sad story into something a little happier and more fascinating, frankly, which is the American women's soccer team. Yes, I am totally biased about the NBA. Do not send me angry tweets. The American women's soccer team began their run for the Women's World Cup this week. They won their match by 13 goals. That's a war crime. Alex Morgan, who's a striker, scored 5 of the goals. Here's what she said after the game.
We really just came into this game, really wanted to showcase ourselves and what we've been preparing for and what we've been working on. And I think we did that, but every goal matters in this tournament. And so that's what we were working on this game. And we got a lot of attacks. And I think that we were really clinical in the number of attacks that we did get.
That was Alex Morgan, a striker on the American women's soccer team. Now, Kimberly, this blowout win drew attention to the pay disparity between the men's team and the women's team. The American women, as I understand it, are paid 38 cents to the men's team's dollar. They've won 3 World Cups. The men have won none of them. They didn't qualify for the World Cup last year.
Let's add on several Olympic gold medals for mm-hmm. the American women's soccer team. Lots of deals. I mean, they're hands down a better team and are paid significantly less. I was looking at some numbers that were compiled on this. FIFA has a total prize pool for the men's World Cup of $400 million. For the women's World Cup, it's a pool of $38 million.
Like, less than a tenth.
It's crazy. So, yes, it was quite the blowout, but these women, in demonstrating their remarkable skill, in some ways highlighted the ridiculous nature of this pay disparity, given how good they are. And even if they weren't that good, the pay disparity is still wild.
Now, Naftali, this is becoming a campaign issue. Some of the 2020 presidential contenders, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, have chimed in on this. They both tweeted their support of equal pay.
Yeah, I mean, this comes at a time, of course, when equal pay, equal representation, not to mention the whole Me Too movement, is very much in the forefront of the country's discussion, as well as the Democratic political discussion. But here you have, sports has a particular kind of emotional impact, visibility. I mean, nothing against insurance agents, but if the issue was whether women insurance agents were getting paid as much as male insurance agents, it wouldn't get the same kind of publicity. So mm-hmm. I think what we're seeing here is an opportunity to discuss this subject, but in a venue that's much more high profile, emotional, and obvious to a lot of people.
It's also, Reid, one of these areas where the president has made a lot of hay politically over the intersection between sports and culture. We know the things that he has said about former 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, for example, the players taking a knee in response to police brutality against African Americans. President Trump was asked about this, about the pay disparity, and said, we will talk about that later. Perhaps a win in France might change that conversation, or he stays out of this for 2020, or he dives into it for 2020.
It seems like the simplest thing in the entire world for him to say, yes, the women's team that's going to win this World Cup should be paid the same as men. I don't know why he didn't take the obvious bait there, but, I don't know. Alex Morgan has qualified for the Democratic debate stage if she wants a place, but I think she'll be a little busy bringing home another World Cup.
That would be great. If they could just fly him right back from France to Miami.
Satellite uplink or something.
I would watch that. I would watch that all day long. One more story that I know Kimberly's eager to talk about. For the second year in a row, a team is hoisting the Stanley Cup for the first time in its history.
For the first time in their history, the St. Louis Blues are the Stanley Cup champions.
That's what it sounded like in Boston's TD Garden when the Blues beat the Boston Bruins last night in Game 7. They scored 4 goals before Boston scored its first, and only late in the third period. This is the first time the St. Louis Blues have won the Stanley Cup in its 52-year history. The other team is the Washington Capitals. Kimberly, you are from St. Louis.
Yes, I am.
You must be feeling good about this,
I'm
but explain that thing about the song Gloria, the Lauren Brannigan song we played earlier.
Well, first I have to say, you played a clip of the Boston hockey rink but the crowd in St. Louis in the Blues home rink and also in Busch Stadium where we play baseball was wild. So it was much louder there, just saying. So anyway, Gloria, the Laura Branigan song, apparently some of the Blues players were like hanging out in a bar in Philly one time and the DJ kept playing Gloria and they were like, let's make that our sort of like victory song. And since they had so many victories, it became all of our songs. And so we are happily living in the 80s right now. I've been watching various permutations of different like St. Louis groups, like our community theater, the Muni did a performance of Gloria. It's been covered. We're all very pleased.
Hey, when you win, you can play whatever you want. You can play whatever you want. One more song we wanted to play before we leave the stage, and this is from a historic moment at the Tony Awards. Ali Stroker won Best Featured Actress in the Musical for her performance of 8-0 Annie in Oklahoma. She is the first disabled performer to win. She uses a wheelchair. We're going out on her rendition of 8-0 Annie's big number, I Can't Say No. Kimberly Adams of Marketplace, thanks for joining us for the hour.
Thank you, Joshua.
Naftali Ben-David of The Washington Post, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Reed Wilson of The Hill, thanks, Reed.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital crew is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A. Never make a complaint till it's too late for reason.